G'day everyone, good to be here again. Really good to hear about hands and feet and your involvement in that. Terrific stuff. And thanks to the Brethren Trust who have been behind that financially. It's really encouraging to hear. They do a great job. And also good to hear about the men's meeting, mate, on Saturday and the games that you play and all that sort of stuff. I'm a firm believer that the real purpose of groups like that of getting together is building relationships, because the building of relationships is where God works. And if you can build relationships through throwing darts at a board, that's great. So I think it's terrific that you're doing that. Well done. Joshua chapter 9. Last week we had a look at Joshua chapter 7 and 8, and we saw some pretty bloodthirsty events that were being recorded, and we applied some responsible hermeneutical principles, which I introduced you to last week. You probably know all about them before that, but we looked at some last week, and we applied some of those hermeneutical. Remember, hermeneutics is the idea of understanding and interpreting and then applying scripture. It's the science of doing that. And we got some hermeneutical principles, and we applied them to those chapters 7 and 8, because they were difficult chapters, just sort of standing by themselves. And we came up with a few life principles coming out of those chapters to influence our lives into the future. Now this week with Joshua 9, we have another interesting chapter. And we need to be very careful, I think, in our interpretation of and application of the content of Joshua chapter 9. And so first of all, I want to read you some selected verses from that chapter, and then summarise the content, and then have a look again at some of those hermeneutical principles. Have a look again at what is God saying to us today in Montmorency through this Joshua chapter 9. So first of all, I'll read verses 1 to 15 of chapter 9. When all the kings heard about Jericho and Ai, those who were west of the Jordan in the hill country, in the Judean foothills, and all along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea towards Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and Jebusites, they formed a united alliance to fight against Joshua and Israel. When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they acted deceptively. They gathered provisions and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and old wineskins cracked and mended, and they wore old patched sandals on their feet and threadbare clothing on their bodies. And their entire provision of bread was dry and crumbly. They went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant land. Please make a treaty with us." Well, the men of Israel replied to the Hivites, "Perhaps you live among us. How can we make a treaty with you?" And they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." And then Joshua asked them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" And they replied to him, "Your servants have come from a faraway land because of the reputation of the Lord your God. For we have heard of his fame and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two Amorite kings beyond the Jordan, Sihon king of Heshbon and Og king of Bashan, who was in Ashtaroth. And so our elders and all the inhabitants of our land told us, 'Take provisions with you for the journey. Go and meet them and say, we are your servants. Please make a treaty with us. This bread of ours was warm when we took it from our houses as food on the day we left to come to you. But take a look. It's now dry and crumbly. These wineskins were new when we filled them. But look, they're cracked. And these clothes and sandals of ours are worn out from the extremely long journey.' And then the men of Israel took some of their provisions, but did not seek the Lord's counsel. So Joshua established peace with them and made a treaty to let them live, and the leaders of the community swore an oath to them." In the next few verses, the deception is found out, and Joshua tries to work out how do I deal with this deception. And so picking the story up in verse 19, "All the leaders answered them, 'We have sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them.' This is how we'll treat them. We'll let them live so that no wrath will fall on us because of the oath we swore to them. And they also said, let them live. And so the Gibeonites became woodcutters and water carriers for the whole community as the leaders had promised them. So that's just a few of the verses from Joshua chapter 9. Let's just try to get into this passage and see what it's actually saying amongst all the ites and all the other words that come up in that passage. Israel's been very successful. We saw that in chapter 8. Very successful in warfare, and the word has been spoken that Israel is not a nation to be played around with. And so the surrounding nations become very afraid of what is Israel going to do to us. And they form an alliance to stand against Israel. But Gibeon has a different idea. The people of Gibeon, which is a township only 19 kilometers northwest of Jerusalem, so it's just 3 days away from Jerusalem, it's a Canaanite city, and it's destined for destruction as the Israelites are fighting for their new land. And so Gibeon come up with this idea that instead of being destroyed by Israel, that they'll have a plan to show that they actually live a long way away, not just 19 kilometers away, but a long way away, and actually are no threat to Israel. So Israel's intent on destroying the Canaanite cities, Gibeon hear about this, and they were afraid and build this deception to take down to them. So they take this rather elaborate deception, and quite clever in some ways, to back up their story about being a long way away. And the idea there is because they're so far away, they never tell Joshua how far away, but so far away that they're really no threat to Israel. They've got their worn out clothes, they've got shoes and bags that look old and they're torn up, and they've got stale food, and they've got old wineskins to make it look like they'd travelled a long way. And so they're no threat to the people of Israel. Joshua actually believes their story. And without consulting God, now that's a key to understanding the passage, without consulting God, he makes a peace treaty with them, thinking that, looking at the crumbly bread and the broken wineskins and the old clothes, thinking they'd travelled a long way, no threat to us. They could actually serve us. We'll make a peace treaty with them, and that's what Joshua and the rest of Israel do. However, 3 days later, they discovered the deception. But the problem is they've made this promise. They've made an oath that they wouldn't attack them because they were so far away, and they actually choose, Israel chooses, Joshua chooses, to be faithful to the promises that they made to these people who are actually not so far away at all, just 3 days away. And so they decide that they're going to live by the promises. They're going to be faithful to the promises that they made, even in the midst of this deception. So it's a mess. That's what it is. You know, this deception is believed. And it's a mess. But in the midst of that mess, Joshua and the rest of Israel decide we have to be faithful because we promised them, and this is what we're going to do. And so the people from Gibeon, the Gibeonites, entered into the workforce in Israel as slaves, and they were involved in woodcutting and water carriers. So let's have a bit of a think about this passage, Joshua chapter 9. Last week we said that one of the principles that we need to abide by when we're looking at Old Testament, well, when we're looking at anything, but certainly Old Testament stories, we need to ask the question, is this passage descriptive or prescriptive? Very important when it comes to Joshua chapter 9. This chapter simply describes an event in the history of Israel. So it is descriptive. It's a description of something that happened. And in this passage, we don't get any prescriptive commands. There's no instructions on how to be deceptive. There's no instructions on how to act in the midst of deception. When you're being deceived, this is how you shall act. There's no prescription at all. We might be able to learn from the story, but it's not a prescriptive passage. It's a descriptive passage. And we need to keep that in mind as we read through and try to find the principles of what's going on here. It's a description, it's a story about something that happened in Israel's history. And then we saw last week that another hermeneutical principle is to apply what I called some macro principles, looking for the macro principles, looking for the principles that are in this descriptive story that can actually be pulled out from the story and applied to us today. They make sense today. So what are the macro principles? And, of course, there's a whole lot in the story about deception. That's what the main part of the story is about. In the case of the Gibeonites, deception worked. It worked. And it was cleverly devised. But there are other examples as well of deception being cleverly devised, and I don't know, did you look at Joshua 2 when we're going through that with Rahab and so forth? Another story of deception there. Rahab was a Canaanite prostitute who deceived the king's men about the spies that she had hidden. But she said, oh, no, they left. They escaped the city last night. You should be chasing after them or else you won't be able to catch them. So she lied. And she used that deception to protect the spies. That story is in Joshua chapter 2. Again, a descriptive story about what happened with Rahab. And it worked. It was something that really helped as far as Israel invading that city. In fact, Rahab is actually mentioned in the New Testament. She's mentioned in Matthew's genealogy as there in the line of Jesus. She's there in James when James names her as a person of good works. And she's in Hebrews as a person of faith. And so you've got another story in Joshua, which you've already covered in this series, where there's deception and it works. So does that mean that we should be learning from this story that deception is okay and that it's all right to deceive one another as long as it works or as long as it's for a good end? You know, maybe the end justifies the means sort of idea. Is that what we learn from here? Well, I don't think we can, because remember I talked about how it's important to take what is said, especially by Jesus, in relation to the things that we're looking at in the Old Testament. There's much teaching in the New Testament that is against deception. It's against falsehood. And it's in support of truth, especially in the teaching of Jesus. So even though we have stories of deception having positive results in the Old Testament, we can't build a theology of the usefulness of deception from those stories if we're going to be true to the teachings of Jesus, if we're going to be true to the teachings that we find in other places in the Bible. We need to interpret what we have described in the Old Testament by the prescriptions that we have there in the teachings of Jesus and in the rest of the New Testament. Another principle that comes out in this passage is the principle of faithfulness. In both accounts of deception in Joshua 2 now and in Joshua 9, we find that faithfulness is there on the part of the Israelites to the promises that they made. God is a faithful God in all that he says to us, and he's always true to his promises. And that's the reason that we are called to be faithful in our following of Jesus as we seek to be holy as God is holy. And so when we make promises, we are called to be faithful to those promises. And that's exactly what Joshua is displaying here. in these passages. Faithfulness to what he said. I said it, I will do it. It's very similar, I think, to what Jesus said. So putting on, remember, we put on our Jesus glasses to look at these passages. And Jesus said, let your yes be yes and your no be no. And in that passage in the Sermon on the Mount, I think he's saying, take your promises seriously. You know, if you promise something, you do it. You don't have to swear by this or swear by that or whatever. If you say something, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Take your promises seriously. I think Joshua is doing that. Even in the midst of the mess, even in the midst of deception, he's taking his promises seriously. But before we get back on to the Jesus glasses, there's another thing that comes through this teaching, this description of the story in Joshua 9, and that is the teaching on seeking God's guidance. This story highlights, I think, how important seeking God in the process of decision making is. Joshua 9 makes the point that but he didn't consult God in the process of decision making, and so he got caught into this elaborate scheme that I would have been caught into it too, just on the surface, because it was an elaborate scheme and it looked good, you know, it looked believable, but he didn't seek God's guidance. And that surprises us, doesn't it, about Joshua, because we know Joshua to be a man who did seek God's guidance, who relied upon him. He was one of the spies, remember, going in. He was one of the two spies that was faithful because he said, God has said this, everything will be okay. So this is a bit of a slip up on his part, probably not true to his character, but in this particular instance, Joshua and the Israelites, he didn't seek God's guidance. I'm reminded of people who did, like in 1 Corinthians 12:32, it talks about the men of Issachar who knew the times and knew what to do because they were people who were seeking after God. They knew the times, they understood what was going on, and so they knew what to do. Or in 2 Chronicles 20 verse 12, it says, Israel didn't know what to do, but they turned their eyes towards God, seeking guidance and empowerment from him. Don't know what to do, Lord, but our eyes are upon you. See, I think that's the prayer that God was looking for from Joshua. God, here's these people from wherever they're from, and I'm believing what they're saying, but my eyes are on you. I don't know what to do, so my eyes are on you. So seeking God's guidance is something that comes out of this passage, a reminder for us to be those who seek God's guidance. You know, this problem of deception is a huge one for us today. It's all around us. We live in a mess of deception, lies, things that go against the truth or a half-truth. I suppose social media has made it more known to us, but it's there just everywhere we turn. People telling falsehoods, you know, what might be called fake news. You get things from Facebook or you get things from other areas of social media, and it's just falsehood. People telling stories just to try to, you know, elaborately make us believe what they believe. And we really need God's guidance. We really need to be those who are understanding the times. We need to be those who are seeking God in the midst of all of the deception that lies around us so that we know what to do. So that we know what to do. We need to be those who are doing what Joshua failed to do in this particular chapter. And he got caught up in the deception. And he got caught up in the consequences of the deception. And it's so easy for us today, folks, to be caught up in the consequences of deception, of half-truths, and to go off on tangents. And this is true in the church as well. You think of false teaching, and this is not a new thing. I mean, you know, one of the main things that that Jesus, when he was writing to through John, when he was writing to the seven churches in Revelation, one of the main things that he despised about the churches that he was writing to was false teaching. You know, you're getting caught up. You're getting caught up in false teaching, in deception. You got to turn from that. I love that last song that we just sang beforehand because it talked about listening to God speak to us and concentrating on truth. You might not have been tuned into that because I was, because I knew what I was speaking on, but it was right through that song. Great song. It's so important for us to be listening for truth and saying to God, God, I have no idea what is the truth here. What do you want us to do? False teaching can just lead us astray and can give us a bad profile and can do a whole lot of damage to what God is saying to us and to the world around us. And so these principles that we see here in Joshua chapter 9 are so important for us today. We're called to faithfulness no matter what. Even in the midst of the mess, we're called to faithfulness. But we're called to be wise about the things that are being told to us, the things that are being spread around, the teaching. Remember in Acts where it said that the Bereans were more noble than the Thessalonians, was it? I've forgotten now, but they were more noble than the other people that Paul was with at that time. Why? Because they listened to Paul and they went home and they checked it out. They went home and they got on their phones and they Googled stuff and they checked it out. You know, how easy it is for us today to check things out, to go back to the Word and to find out if what was being said, in this case it was Paul and his teaching, find out what was being said. Was it true to the Word? Was it true to what they knew from their history and other teaching and so forth? Oh, we need to do that. I'd love it if you went home and checked out what I'm saying. And found out and then found out, yeah, what I'm saying is right and you can write me an email. It's really, really important to be able to see through the deception, whether it's coming from the church or whether it's coming from social media or politics or wherever it might be. And so seeking God's guidance, it's an important principle that comes through this passage. But back to the Jesus glasses, he focused on truth. A whole lot. And especially in John's gospel. As I was putting this together, I was surprised to find that nearly all the references to Jesus talking about truth are in John's gospel. It was something that was really important to him. I am the way, the truth, and the life. All of these are from John. I am the way, the truth, and the life. That's up there, isn't it? Jesus was full of grace and truth, John said. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ, John said. Worship God in truth. You will know the truth and it will set you free. Jesus prays that we'll be sanctified by the truth that is God's word. He says the reason that he came into the world was to testify to the truth. The Spirit is the Spirit of truth who will guide us, see, seeking discernment, guide us into all truth. And he also says that Satan is the father of lies. Well, he says when Satan speaks and he lies, he's just being true to his character. That's what Jesus said. He's being true to his character because that's who he is. He's the father of lies. Whereas Jesus says, I am the truth. So you see, there's no way that we can put an understanding onto Joshua chapter 9 and say, well, actually, deception's okay. If it works, deception's okay. No, that's pragmatism. You know, just because something works, atomic bombs work. Are they good? No. And so, you know, we can't say that something is good just because it works. We're called to be people of the truth and to be discerning about deception. And Jesus' teaching on truthfulness is prominent right throughout John's gospel in particular. So deception works at times, but it's not Christ-like. We have stories about it in the Old Testament, but it's not Christ-like. It's not what we're called to be. We're called to be those who are truth tellers. That's our calling, no matter what the consequences. So my conclusion to all of that, as we face the future with so much falsehood out there, we must not fall for the deception that is so prevalent in social media and in a whole lot of people's stories and in false teaching delivered from the church. We need to be those with eyes wide open to see what God is saying and what he is calling us to be and to do. Truth trumps deception every time, no matter what. There was a book written a few years ago now that talked about whenever you look at pictures of the gurus and the desert fathers and so forth of other religions, in meditation, they have bowed heads and their eyes are closed. But when you look at pictures of the Christian fathers and the Christian teachers of the day, their eyes are wide open. And the idea from that is that we gotta know what's going on. We gotta know what's going on around us, understanding the times through God's perspective. And that's what I'm suggesting here, that we be people of the truth and refuse deception. God bless you.